back to another show of Atlanta Sales Talk Radio, and I am your host with Steve Cadley, along with my co-host and man behind the scenes, or man behind the curtain, so to speak, Andy Lowe.
You know, what I need is the fire and the smoke. When we talk about man behind the curtain, I want to be the great and powerful Oz.
You
know,
you'll always be my Oz, Andy.
I don't know if I'm afraid of that comment or what, but
as long as I start winking at you, then you can start to sweat. All
right. You didn't say it was that kind of show.
That's right. Anything goes here, Joe. I appreciate it. So anyway, we have a wonderful show tonight. Tonight, I feel like I'm a little bit on the Conan O'Brien show. We have a wonderful show. Actually, we have some wonderful guests talking about all things sales. That's what we do here at Atlanta Sales Talk Radio. We have today is the Business Revisionists with Chris Roseman. And also with us is Joe Wilson from Performance Improvement Group. And we'll have some interesting stories from Joe, I know, from Joe. And then last but of course not least is Mike Scher from Frontline Selling, the prospecting powerhouse that is based here in Atlanta. So look forward to hearing from each of those. So I'm going to start off with Chris. Chris, you are my reluctant guest, if you will, because I was teasing you. I said, this is a show all about sales. And you said, well, I'm not really in sales. And but yet, before you came here, you were saying, well, I'm working on like about 5 proposals. I'm like, proposals, not in sales. So, Chris, tell me all about yourself and Business Revisionists.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I actually go by Christine because...
Thank you.
No, and actually it has to do with sales, because when I make a call and then they say, oh yeah, it's Chris, then I walk in and then they think that it's a guy that's going to show up and then a woman shows up. So actually it's sales based is the reason why recently, like over in the past year or so, that I changed my name, because I didn't want to be, you know, them thinking a boy was going to show up.
See, I follow her social media feed, so I knew this.
Oh.
Very good. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I missed that feed. I haven't been on Twitter today.
No Twitter account. So,
well, Christine, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Business Revisionists.
Yes. We work with companies that have a disconnect from where they are and where they want to be. And I have a very good idea. Actually, I've taken a test that shows that I'm an experiential problem solver. So I can look at something and I can see what's missing. Now, I can't necessarily go in and fix everything, but I do have a consortium of partners, and that's what the Business Revisionists are all about, is that if there's something that has to do with HR, I can bring somebody in from the Burke group, just different things that I can't do. But things that I can do, I love to get in there and, like Andy, roll up my sleeves, help them get to the next level, get from where they are to where they want to be.
Good. I'm reminded again, Andy, is that we need to get it gone, because every time we have some other organization that I think highly of, you know, mentioned, I got a gong, because the Burke Group is a great group around their assessment tools and so on. I just
right.
wanted to
oh, some yeah, yeah.
So, but yeah, so you come in, your ability is really to see the gaps, is what I'm hearing.
Correct, yes.
Good, and that's what the Business Revisions is all about, and then bringing in a cadre of experts to help resolve that.
Exactly.
Well, speak to that a little bit, Christine, because you know I'm a huge fan of this model, and I think that companies often get lost in what's really going on. I mean, when you're in it, you're emotional, it's your company, it's your baby, and you mm-hmm. miss a lot of what's going on. Talk about how you come in and bring that third-party view to light to really help companies identify their strengths and weaknesses.
Well, first of all, as you know, is that they have to be receptive to some change, and they have to know that they have to be able to admit that there's maybe something amiss, and that usually shows up in revenues. It shows up with people not being on the same page within an organization. And so if they're able to admit to a pain point, then they're receptive to hearing something. What I try to do is I can be very blunt, so I have to rein it back in so that I can say it to somebody in the way that they're going to be able to hear it, and it's not going to be judgmental, and they're going to be receptive to hearing what a possible solution might be. So, but they first, of course, have to start talking about what the problem is and what the what ideally they'd love to have the solution be. So as far as selling then, I guess what I'm doing is I'm finding out what that really getting them to identify, talk about the pain point, talk about what they really want, and then be able to really show what that disconnect is. And in that disconnect, then they're more receptive to saying, okay, yeah, let's go ahead, let's talk further and bring in a solution and help us with this with this problem.
Sounds like sales to me.
Yeah.
Also, it sounds like a little bit of Irish diplomacy. Is your Irish diplomacy?
No.
That's the ability to tell someone to go screw themselves and have them walk away thanking you. It sounds like, you know.
And buy you
what
a
you're
drink.
Doing.
Yeah,
that's right.
And have a beer with them, too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I think you lead with the beer. That's how you get Irish diplomacy to work.
Exactly. Or a little Jameson, depends on that. Yeah. Good. So, yeah. So, and really, so you're coming in, business revisions are, because I know you mentioned you're doing some change management work with some clients. And is that coming in and doing a discovery level and then figuring out how to do the change? Or is it just coming in to see what kind of change needs to happen?
They already know that there are some things going on that are just not in alignment with their company values.
Okay, good.
So what my solution is let's go, instead of trying to get everybody to change, which they don't really won't want to because they're going to feel like they're shamed into doing something, is why don't we get them involved, make it inclusive, collaborate with the people that are the ones that you would like to see the change from. And so by doing that, the change will happen because they're going to be involved in the solution. And being involved and having buy-in and being collaborative is really about the only way that people do end up changing. So it's I bring fun into it and bring humor into it. And I like to, what we're doing is actually making a caricature of what they don't want. Things that are happening, but making it really bad. So it's going to be a video of me talking to you, texting, not really paying attention, doing every faux pas you could possibly think of, like what not to wear, what not to do.
Interesting.
And then it's like using the principles or the values, the core values of that company, what would that change look like? So you're, this team over here, you know, break it up into the five core values, and then each team will come up with a solution. What would integrity look like? What would respect look like in that situation?
Good.
Keeps it on their mind.
And so this is part of the implementation and the design work that you're doing.
Right.
So I call that the democratization, getting them
like
involved in
word.
The solution.
Yeah,
that's.
I think these days you've got to get, you have to, if you really want somebody to pay attention to you, you have to take their PDA from them and paste it on your forehead, and then they'll look at you. They may not pay attention to you, but at least they'll be looking at you.
Well, and I think if you're going to have some change happen, you have to create a little bit of discomfort in some way, shape, or form.
Oh, yeah.
And that sounds like fun. You should. It's like Halloween every day then.
Oh, yeah.
Well, say you have to create a lot of, you have to create a lot of discomfort or make them aware that things are really fouled up because, I mean, so many people will buy the treadmill, but they won't get on the damn thing. And as a consequence, you don't get any
true.
Improvement.
Yeah.
Consequences. All right. So, Joe, tell us about Performance Improvement Group.
We basically grow sales and margins by fixing sales teams. We take a kind of practitioner hands-on approach to what's going on out there. I had been consulting. I found that somewhat frustrating from the standpoint that you would give people advice and they'd say, oh, yeah, we'll do that, and then they wouldn't do it.
You're back to the treadmill example, right?
Yeah, right, yeah. And just because you got a treadmill in the basement doesn't mean you're actually going to burn any calories. You actually have to get on the blasted thing and you know, fire it up and walk with it. And, you know, and I've had clients that, you know, when you sit with them and they, you know, they had been losing 3% of their volume year after year and they wonder what their problem is, and I'm sitting there thinking, oh, I know what the problem is. I'm looking at the problem. You know, it's
exactly.
You won't change anything of any significance. So that gets to be a problem. So, you know, my experience was that most sales organizations, most business organizations really cannot escape Pareto. Pareto's the Italian mathematician who created the Pareto rule, the 80-20 rule that everybody talks about. It's mathematically sound, and 80% of sales organizations don't have good processes. They don't prepare when they go out on a sales contact. They don't really have any sales objectives. Most sales managers don't train and develop their people. They don't provide them good evaluation. They don't provide them good feedback. And you can't be a sales manager when you're a desk jockey back at headquarters or in the office. You've got to, if you're going to be an effective sales manager, you got to go out there and see them in operation in front of customers, and you got to do it with consistency. And then you got to be willing to and aggressive about providing feedback. And doing that and doing a lot of coaching by asking a lot of questions. How did that go? You know, you said the objective for the sales call was to do A, B, and C. Did we make A, B, and C? Well, why didn't we do well with B? Mm-hmm. And get them to think their way through it. And it's kind of like I worked at one organization, and somebody, the guy that was in the office next to me, stuck a note on my door on the little glass panel one day. It was nicely made up and framed because I had somebody in the office and I couldn't see what it was. And when I went out after the meeting was over, it said, "The doctor is in." And I went to him and I said, "What's this about?" And he says, "How do you do it?" He says, "How do you listen to these people, you know, come in and complain about their problems?" I said, "Frankly, if you let them talk long enough, they usually solve their own problems." And, and you know, or they come up with some solutions and then you get them to commit to doing something about it. And then they get better at it. And when they get better at it, you end up with better results. And that's really what it's all about, is we try and, you know, people get frustrated. There's a lot of small and mid-sized business owners look at sales forces and, you know, it's kind of like herding cats for them. They can't get them to do what they want them to do. Everybody's focused on the last stages of the pipeline, when really sales managers ought to be focused on the early stages of the pipeline. You set up prospects, and you know, if you don't do a good job of really qualifying the prospect, you really are going to waste a lot of time. And you know, one of the things I'll tell salespeople, one of the things I'll tell salespeople is, if you're going to lose the account, lose early.
Lose fast.
It's the little league rule. You want the little league rule. You know, get beat up badly in the first inning, and don't waste any more time. Because if you're not going to win the damn thing, then don't bother, you know, investing any more time into it. So
you're better off spending that time looking for somebody who can buy from you.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And then nurturing them through the process of letting them discover they've got a problem and letting them realize that you might have the solution to their problem, and let them quantify and feel the pain, and then work them down the pipeline, because then you got a much better chance. And our approach is, we go out and do that for you. We won't just tell you to do these things, because I mean, the world's filled with advice and internet blogs and you know, good advice and newsletters from all kinds of people, whether it's local guys like Greg Alexander or Huthwaite and Neil Rackham and things like that.
Or Miller Hyman,
yeah. I've got
Gong.
I've got a set of charts from Miller Hyman that I got when I was working with Cincinnati Bell years ago on a project. But
I'll just hand you my card just in case.
Definitely.
All right, so Joe, I hear a lot about execution, and I think and I hear Mike over here, I think there's some synergies here, so I wanted to just, Mike, tell us about Frontline Selling and yourself a little bit.
Sure, Steve. So Frontline Selling, what we do is we help B2B sellers master their prospecting cycle. A lot of attention is, you know, paid to, you know, marketing activities on the front end, and then sales activities and sales process and sales methodology, and that's, both of those are very important. But we sit in between those, is between the marketing end of it and between the sales cycle, there is a prospecting cycle. So it might take you, if you're a seller, 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 years to sell something, and you go through some various stages, and you have a lot of discipline around that, and there's a lot of books written about it. But before there's a sales cycle, what we've done is we've identified those processes within the prospecting cycle. How do you identify the right person, whether they come to you, whether they're raised their hand and they're interested in you, or they're a targeted account and you're interested in them? How do you gain access to them? How do you get that first meaningful business conversation? Longest journey starts with a single step. Every sales cycle starts with the first conversation. And then how do you engage in that first conversation? Because what a lot of people I don't think understand is they're selling things, especially in a B2B world, they're selling things to people who don't know who they are, Mm-hmm. And don't wake up in the morning saying, I need to buy one of these today. So how do you go out and engage somebody? You have a chicken and egg problem. And to us, that's the subtle but important distinction between demand creation and lead generation. So we've developed a process and a methodology, a color by numbers approach on how to create demand one meaningful business conversation at a time. And Steve, if you were traveling from, you sell to sales leaders all the time, right?
Absolutely.
So if you were traveling from Atlanta to Chicago and, you know, you printed your boarding pass out and the gate agent called your row or your zone and said, oh, Steve, you know, Miller Hyman, but by the way, Joe Smith, the VP of sales, worldwide sales for one of your top 10 target accounts is on this plane. He's sitting in seat 1A. You could sit anywhere you want. What seat are you going to choose?
That's right, 1B.
Yeah. So what we've done is we figured out how to make that happen over and over again. We've developed some process, some methodology, and some technology to do that. And we deliver it either as a training skills development environment where we will teach people to fish, or we have a staff of folks here in Alpharetta who will do the fishing on behalf of our clients. So all we're really doing is taking our 10 years of best practices and sharing it with our clients.
Well, maybe you can compare and contrast a little bit the traditional approach to getting to the key decision makers versus how you guys do it.
Sure, yeah. So I like to call it the traditional approach, I affectionately call it the waterboarding method, right?
Oh,
so,
nice.
So that is, you start with a value proposition. And, how do you know it's good? Well, because marketing said so. And then you get a list because you create some collateral, and then you get a list that you either, a list of contacts that you built the list, you bought the list, you stole the list from somewhere, and then you take action. You either call, or email, and then what happens? You make 100 phone calls. We already know the list isn't that good, so about a third of them are no good. And then of the other 67, you get 60 voicemail, surprise, surprise, right? Three people hang up on you right away. Another three people listen to you courteously because they're from the South, right? then they hang up on you and say, bless their little hearts. And then one person says, yeah, I'll talk to you.
Right.
Well, in that case, you had 7 synchronous conversations. People are following the math on that. You know, but those conversations only last a minute or two. So how well considered could the decisions, whether they said yes or no, how well considered could they be? So, you know, that's a traditional approach, and the problem with that is that the list is never that good. There's no way to validate it, but most importantly is you cannot make these people pick up the phone any more than they're going to. And guess what? Neither can we. So they're only going to pick up the phone a small percentage of time, 6 or 7% at a time. It's what you do in the other 93, 94% of the time is where you're going to make an impact, because our approach is a little different. We communicate differently in the 21st century, 2012, than we did 20 years ago or 30 years ago, right? Some people are email-centric. Some people are voicemail-centric. Some people give their administrative assistants more domain over the calendar. So the approach now is really using multiple touch points in a very synchronized way, but most importantly, in a way where it survives your actual effort of doing it, where once you hang up the phone now, you go on to the next one. But how could each company we call into, we talk about social networking, which is just word of mouth powered by technology. How do we get that message promoted throughout an organization through various levels and get people to re-promote our message while we're not doing it? And that's where we gain great levels of productivity. So our approach is using a almost like a social prospecting and more of a buyer-centric approach. Because if these people are really interested in improving sales performance or in operational performance, throughout their organization or financial or whatever it might be, that they'll want to talk to you.
Sure. So you're actually creating a whole storyline, then, more than just the old dialing for dollars and saying, hopefully somebody picks up the phone and wants to talk to me or has enough time to talk to me, and I can gain their interest with something that's compelling enough. But you're creating some sort of story where it starts to get re-promoted inside the organization. So say more about that. It's really interesting.
Exactly. And it's really, the concept has actually been around for a long, long time. If you think about a business-to-consumer marketer, is somebody like McDonald's or they do all this type of advertising in a number of impressions, a number of different ways to communicate, because not everybody sees the billboards on the highway, everybody reads the ad in the newspaper. But they know that X number of impressions will create Y number of people to walk through a McDonald's. Well, we use the same concept, but we just do it in a one-to-one marketing concept where X number of touch points through voicemail or email or admin conversations or referrals, and we've actually studied this over the past 10 years. We've done a whole bunch of, created some business intelligence, and we've built some technology that actually takes that intelligence into some predictive algorithms where on any given day, our folks and our clients, what they do is they don't decide who to call. The system will say, based on how you've communicated in the past, here are the people. If you only have time to call 10 people, you have 100 people to call back. Here are the 10 people who are statistically most probable to want to have that first meaningful business conversation.
That's a critical skill that, frankly, salespeople in general don't have. And frankly, it makes a lot of sense these days because of the way selling is evolving and the way buying is evolving for the most part.
I think salespeople are fascinated by prospecting. Most of them could watch it be done all day long.
Yeah, exactly. None of them want to do it. Nobody wants to pick up and do a cold call, but a good lead generator is a real good skill that most face-to-face salespeople really don't have, and I think most companies waste time and money by getting their sales reps to either do marketing collateral or to do prospecting.
Yeah, we have a term, a phrase that we use is that prospecting is the Rodney Dangerfield of selling. Now everybody, it's something everybody, it gets no respect. Everybody thinks they know how to do it well. And but like we look that. At it differently. That's the way it's treated. And you know, our mission is you know, and our approach is, you know, prospecting is the calisthenics of selling. There, you know, and if you think about calisthenics are like push-ups and sit-ups and jumping jacks, and what matters more, how many push-ups you do or how well you do each one of them?
Right.
Well, it's how well you do each one of them. And if you break the prospecting cycle, all those activities down into individual calisthenics, there's a right way to do it and there's every other way. And if you do them the right way, what we find is that salespeople can see the results, then they'll actually, nobody loves to do prospecting, but they are more apt to do it if they know that they can get predictable outcomes from their efforts.
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm.
Let me bring this question back.
Science to do it, yeah.
Let me bring this question back to Joe and Christine, because I think you guys might have some good perspective here. Who's to blame? Where's the fault at? Why are our salespeople not getting this? Is it because we're not training them right? Or are they just conditioned to old ideas? I mean, Christine, especially with that third-party view, and you go in and you kind of look at what's not working, where are the breakdown in organizations that they're failing to take the correct approach to driving their sales team?
I think a lot of sales managers and senior management don't realize how much things are changing. And there's this, I'm going to hang on to cold calling until I die kind of mentality. And a lot of people manage salespeople by quantity versus quality. Mm-hmm. And then they don't have them focus on the things that they should do best. And I, you know, having somebody who is a whiz at prospecting do the prospecting makes a heck of a lot of sense. And then what'll happen is that the sales reps will realize, you know, I got a prospect from Mike. This is going to be a good one. I better call these people now. And that's what you want, you know, as opposed to, oh yeah, marketing just sent us 45 more leads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that a lot of salespeople end up getting really jaded. Because they think, oh, this is supposed to be a good lead, and all the leads have been pretty bad. But also is that I think that the whole environment has shifted so much that, like when you just identify and have systematized something that works and that's effective, that has to be communicated. And it's clearly to the prospector and the salesperson to say, this is, you're going to actually get results from this, because then it's like, I think they end up feeling fruitless in their efforts and thinking, oh, great. And, you know, like it's everything's a fluke, and it's not. When you have a system like that you've put together, it's no longer a fluke.
You
no, it's not. No, it's not. But to answer that question a little bit more in terms of, you know, why people aren't successful at this is, part of it has to do with, some old wives' tales and some, you know, they're just, but a lot of it has to do with, we talk about leads and you know, I play semantics sometime on this, but there, we make a subtle but important distinction between lead generation and demand creation. I made reference to that before. And, you know, most sales guys sit around and say, hey, I just wish I had more leads. But I can make the argument that if somebody doesn't know who you are and doesn't wake up in the morning saying, I need to buy one of these today, I can make the argument that a lead for what you're selling doesn't exist. No wonder they're frustrated. They're looking for something that's not there, or certainly not in enough quantity. So they need to understand that, and there's a systemic failure to understand what reality is in terms of what you're trying to accomplish. And, you know, the marketers are in this whole lead paradigm. And I'm not saying that's bad. I'm that in some cases it makes a lot of sense. But when it's not working, they say, well, we don't need more leads. We need more qualified leads, or we need more this lead. But the fact of the matter is, you need to create demand, because while they don't know who you are, they are struggling with all the business issues and pains every single one of our clients solves, whether their prospects consciously acknowledge it or not. So it's really, how do you tap into that latent pain? And if they would just think about, what do I need to do to tap into that latent pain to engage people on the business issue? Most customers, prospects, they don't care how a problem gets solved. They just care that it does get solved. They don't care if you can do it with technology or an abacus. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it's a difference between interest and intent. I mean, I find nothing more annoying than downloading a white paper and then getting a phone call from a company. You know, oh, we saw you downloaded our white paper, you know, 3 weeks ago or 3 minutes ago. And it's kind of like, yeah, that's what I did. I downloaded a white paper. I don't intend to buy it. But what you're doing when you do good qualification up front is you're separating those people who have a casual interest from people who are trying to solve some sort of an itch or pain. And their intent translates into, this is somebody really worth talking to and pursuing and doing a serious diagnosis on what's the real level of pain that they have. And you know, and as a consequence, then you can sell them something of worth.
Right. And most people, most sales folks think that these key players, these decision makers are hiding behind 8-foot concrete walls with 2 feet of electrified barbed wire and a moat. And their job is to go, they have to think like a criminal, Joe, to get to you in order to do that. But the fact of the matter is that most of these folks, that's not the problem. They're all focused on, how do I get past the gatekeeper? How do I do this? The problem is different, and we make people aware of this, is that these folks want to talk to people like you or people like them. They have an obligation to, and why not? Every single one of our clients has solutions to help their clients run their business better, faster, cheaper, more effectively. So why wouldn't I want to improve my sales performance or improve my team's productivity like Christine does, right? Why wouldn't I want to do that? The challenge is that Christine's not the only one calling me. There are hundreds of people who want to talk to me, and I only have time to talk to, even if I wanted to, 2 or 3 people. So the challenge isn't how do I get through the infrastructure. The challenge is how do I get Christine to choose me as one of those 2 or 3 people to talk to versus all the other folks.
Well, here's a question. What do you say to companies that sell a nice-to-have versus a must-have? If there's pain and my company's struggling with revenues and you have a product or service that helps me increase revenues, that's a good pain. But what if it's a technology that will make my business, you know, easier or sexier, but not necessarily a pain point that I've got to act on right now.
Right. Well,
good luck with that.
Make it.
Well, if you think about it, though, what you're describing is what most of us sell. Mm-hmm. We sell something that that's what sales is all about, is making the nice to have must have. The fact of the matter is that, you know, if you go to any shopping mall or whatever, there's clothes you can buy that are all nice to have, but you don't buy them all, right? But at some point, you buy some of them. You make some decisions, so you do prioritization. Every single one of these customers have a whole slew of problems that we all can solve, but they can't work on all of them simultaneously. There's not enough time or money or manpower in the world to do them. But so the idea is, how do we raise that level of pain to say, hey, this is the most important one. This is one of the top 2 or 3 initiatives. And that's mostly by just making people aware of, you know, how your solution can go ahead and impact the business. And
you need to understand what their pain is? So, I mean, that's kind of where the key part is, I'm thinking about in your demand generation, is you trying to raise your solution among all of those opportunities or solutions available to them, So how do we increase the pain?
Well that and oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that by knowing the industry that you're selling to, or know what those problems look like. It's kind of like if you're a runner, and I know that at some point, you know, you're running 10 miles, you're going to need some water. And if you're saying, no, thanks, I'm not thirsty, I have to like let you know that like you're going to have cramps at the end of it. And tonight you're going to be dying. So it's knowing what really is going to be the outcome if they don't have the water.
Well, that's where you strategically position your water sales station, right? Don't sell at mile one, sell at mile
eight.
Right. But they're going to want you by mile eight.
And what does that runner care about at that moment? What they care about is winning the race or running faster or beating a time.
Right.
And so you're not selling them water. You're selling them better performance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is
yeah.
what you're selling. So do they want to perform better? Absolutely. That's why they're in the race. So, Steve, to answer your question, it's one of the things that we do is we talk about separating prospecting from selling.
Mm-hmm.
And so prospecting is, because I asked you about that plane ride, and you said you'd sit next to that guy. Of course, that'd be a good day. Well, you don't know if he has budget or need or anything like that. You just know he's likely to have it, right? Mm-hmm. And so the whole idea is in the prospecting, it's all about getting their attention around the subject matter. They'll tell you if that's important, and it needs to be typically the higher up you go in the organization, the more strategic that needs to be.
Sure.
Selling's what happens once you're there. Now, you'll do your preparation and your research on, you know, when you're sitting next to the Joe Smith on the airplane, because if you knew, you had it planned, you'll be prepared to have that conversation.
If I were planned, absolutely. And it would be able to have my, what I call the valid business reason and understanding their pain points and where I'm actually going to have that conversation. I think you're right on. It's the selling process where it begins at that point.
Yeah.
But it's, I think, where we go back to that conversation, Joe, as you're going into the top of the funnel. And I think about, you know, or Mike, where your solution comes into play is really understanding and getting the attention and getting mind share in an organization to help make sure that they are in, you can get them in the funnel.
Well, really, just to get their attention to have the first conversation, but then somebody like Joe, he had mentioned it before, he says, well, you'd be surprised at how many salespeople don't prepare for that first conversation don't do that.
They don't prepare for any conversation.
How many times have we heard that?
But you also talked about you know, winning deals early, or disqualifying them out early.
Right.
If you're going to have a conversation, an appointed conversation with an executive, you know, there's a best practice, which I'm sure you can share about, you know, what are the things that you would prepare for? And we find that because, you know, we can only lead our horses to water. We can't make them drink.
Right.
So we're really good about getting the first conversation.
Well,
we do find a huge need of, you know, you only get one chance to make that first impression.
Right. You start to put things into the funnel. And when funnels are drawn, they're very wide at the top and they start to narrow down. What happens with most organizations is the funnel stays pretty much like a pretty big tube. And then all of a sudden at the end, it shrinks. Because you have a handful of wins and a whole, you know, a small
bunch of
number
that are cooking,
and then you end up with all these no decisions, which meant that
is the company I always wish I worked for.
No
this
decisions.
Company called No Decision.
Yeah, right.
They win so many deals.
They do. Yeah. They do. But you know, this whole idea of loading that funnel early on is very important in order to get things going, and then you've got to make sure that. You talk about three things basically with people. What's the impact on the revenue of the company? What's the impact on the expense? Can you mitigate the risk? Or are there any personal drivers that manager, if it's not the CEO or whatever, has that, you know, can be a personal win? One of the people I like to sell most to is a CFO, because if you get a CFO excited about a project, there's always budget. They'll cut somebody.
They'll find it. Yeah.
They'll find it.
The proverbial line I say in any organization, that above this line they think ROI, they find the money if it's worth it, and then below the line is budget. I don't have the budget for that this year.
Right.
To that point. Mm-hmm. But that's a great point. Selling to the CFO, I think I go back to getting the attention of a CFO. How would you go about doing that, Mike, in your model? I mean,
Well, think about, you know, what is a CFO, and in every industry, there's certain sorts, you know, certain things that, mm-hmm. they care about.
Sure.
And the list in any industry is generally, at any given point in time, that list is pretty small, mm-hmm. right? What do they care about? They care about growing revenues, reducing expenses, you know, maximizing cash flow, managing risk, maximizing asset utilization. So anything that falls into one of those five categories are things that they care about. So when the whole Sarbanes-Oxley thing came out, and there was the threat of the $1 million lawsuit or fine on the CFO, well, that would get their attention. So you kind of know what those things are.
You could find that stuff out too. I mean, if you're selling to CFOs, and you need to have a subscription to CFO Magazine, which you can get, no problem. Just sign up. Number two, if you're selling to a particular industry, you can go to their industry associations and look at their national programs, or when they bring everybody together, and look at the agenda and who's talking about what. I mean, when I was doing some work in the medical arena, I'd never worked in that one at all, but one of the things I discovered that really was on the minds of people, I talked to the CIO at a Gwinnett hospital, and he said, well, the thing I'm most worried about is ICD-10. And I said, what in the world is that?
I know what that is.
Yeah, and he said, well, there's 13,000 codes used in medicine right now, and by October of 2013, there's going to be 62,000 codes. Mm-hmm. He said, that's a bit of a problem. And, you know, and he mm-hmm. went on to explain that, and I thought, oh, okay.
It's now up to ICD-12 now.
Yeah. Yeah. So
wow.
It's just...
think about that.
You know, but you can find that information out, and I'm sure that's what Mike does, they look at their industries.
But that's only part of it. Part of it is the message, and that's actually the easy part, because most of our clients know what those things are. If you're in the healthcare
sure.
field, ICD-10 is something that's a big issue, and everybody cares about it because it's all part of the healthcare mandate and all that stuff. But... whatever the message is important. But what people miss is how they communicate that message. It's the synchronized repetition of that message through multiple channels. And most sellers grossly underestimate the quantity and quality of how many times a message needs to get out there and the efficacy of that message. So the messages are easy to come by. It's most people quit way too soon before they get their attention, because the first couple times I pick up the phone and, you know, if I call mm-hmm. CFO, I sound like Charlie Brown's teacher to him no matter what. But it's communicating that message through multiple touch points and multiple levels within the organization. And then you let the informal communication infrastructure of that organization, the social aspect of that organization, if you will, to take over for you and promote your message when you're not there. And it's kind of like, you know, what it says in the side view mirror of your car, which is, you know.
Closer than they appear.
Yeah, you just appear Absolutely. Bigger than you are.
So what I'm hearing also is that it's not just one person. If I'm calling into the CFO to try and find an opportunity, let's say I have a change initiative for business revisions, I know that they have a need for Christine's efforts, and I'm not necessarily just calling into that one individual in the C-suite. I'm calling into other people. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, absolutely. And I'll ask Christine for her solution. She doesn't sell to one person. You don't impact one person.
No. In fact, sometimes the client isn't even aware of the other stakeholders within the organization that it's affecting. And recently, I've been working with a company that I said, you have got to get HR involved in this. You're treading on their territory, and you don't want that to happen, because you wouldn't want them treading on your territory. So sometimes just positioning it in a way that they can see it, of like, oh yeah, I didn't think if they came into sales and started telling me how to train my people, I wouldn't like it. But the thing is, yeah, you have. There are other stakeholders, and it's good to make sure that everybody is on the same page.
Right. Well, the CEO mm-hmm. has a vision. In case of your solution, the CEO has a vision for the organization and some objectives and you know, commitments that he makes to the board, that everybody's got to play in the sandbox nicely in order mm-hmm. to help. Right, the CFO wants to do it cost effectively. The HR folks, it impacts their training and personal development. Mm-hmm. And the salespeople, it affects their ability to onboard people. So there's a whole myriad of things. And so you know, who cares about that? Well, lots of different people care about that. So if I'm the CEO of a company and you're presenting me and you get my attention that there's a solution out there that will help me increase sales, well, that's going to help me achieve what, you know, my commitments to the board.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to, what am I going to do with that? I'm going to look at that and say, I'm going to forward it on to, you know, to my VP of sales and say, hey, check this out. And so what happens is I'm doing your work for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Promoting your message. And that's how it works. I might even forward it on to HR and say, hey, maybe we should add this to a training curriculum.
Yeah.
So that's how we do it.
You've got to find the other people who have a stake in what's going on. And I learned that decades ago in Miami when I was pitching, you know, and I had gotten the decision maker all gung-ho about something, and I'm in a meeting around a conference table with about 9 people, and there's one woman staring at me. She's never asked a question. She's got a scowl on her face, and I turned to her, and
don't
I finally
said... Don't you usually have that effect on women, though, Joe?
Yeah, yeah. And I turned to her, and I remember her name to this day, Vi Stridio, and I said, what is it about this that bothers you? And she said, nothing. And I said, no. And so she said, we've heard this before, and it didn't work. And I went into a, if I guarantee that I'm here that whole weekend and went through all the details with her, she said, okay, if you do that, then I'll be on board with it. And she would have been the one person that could have just tossed some sand in the gears, and
sure.
that would have been the end of it. As soon as
you left the room, she would say, hey, we've been down this path, and
right.
And you would have never been able to address that objection.
Right. Well, and it was an unstated one. It was just on her face, you know.
Yeah. Good.
And I don't play cards very well, but that one was too easy to miss.
Well, maybe she doesn't play cards well either.
That's true, too.
You know, I do run into a problem, and I'd like to hear what you guys have to say about it. That is that it is much easier for me to talk to a CEO of a company than the management. Because I'm very strategic, and I can appeal to the strategy that a C-level will have. But when it comes to getting the management to buy into it, sometimes I'm not as effective because I'm giving this big picture, and they want this small. I'm using something here at the table. I guess you guys can't see that. So, but then is that... They're looking at one specific area that really affects them.
Right.
So
that's very common. It doesn't happen anywhere else. And I don't think that doesn't... I think it's outside the norm in corporate America, wouldn't you say?
No. I mean, when you're the guy who's running a platoon in the military, you're not worried about the strategic bombing campaign or the Navy's problems. You just want ammo, you know, fresh batteries for the radios and lots of food and water. And all these other issues are of no relevance to you. But if you can zero in on their particular issues, then, you know, it's like asking Vi Stridio, what is it about this that bothers you? Well, I don't get. Oh, well, tell me about it.
And
I think a lot of people don't do the diagnosis very well.
Part of that is a personality or style alignment.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a certain type of personality that a typical CEO would have, which is not going to be deep in the weeds, very analytical for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to be much more strategic and, you know, more visionary and maybe you just happen to align to that. And,
mm-hmm.
and so part of that is just really understanding the other, you know, styles that are out there in terms of the analytical person or, the different types of, you know, like a typical disc alignment kind of thing. And understanding how they behave. And that's the way you're going to have to relate to them because you're not going to change them.
No, and I know that. And actually what I end up doing a lot of times is that if I know that that person is very analytical, I will bring in a SME, some sort of special matters expert that can help me because if it starts getting too... detailed, I get lost. I get lost in the details, and I'm totally ineffective.
That's the right thing to do,
right,
is to bring somebody else the right skill set in.
Yeah.
Because, again, you're not going to change them, and it's kind of hard for you to change yourself.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Well, on the other side of that coin, in trying to get managers and people like that on board, don't we find ourselves often interfacing a culture of, I'll just use the term responsibility. It's kind of like if you've got your own car and you take it out on the highway, you ever notice you're very careful because you don't want anybody to run into you. You take a deep breath if somebody swerves towards your lane or whatever. But if I'm in a rental car, I'm like, bring it on. I got the insurance. You know? Yeah. So we've taught our managers that really, you know, it's don't worry. So they can't even focus on the big picture because they got to cover their own behind.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I experienced that. Do you guys see the same thing out there?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, that's what Christine is encountering or what she's describing. I was just telling the story earlier this morning about I used to sell ERP systems back in the 90s. We'd have these like 3-day long demos, and we're talking about the separating vision from the, you know, the visionary people who are the budget makers, and then the people who you have to satisfy. And I remember talking about like payroll or something like that, and we spent 45 minutes in a demonstration talking about the employee number and so talk about getting in the weeds and analytical, but that person was only concerned about that, you know, that was her vision of and her responsibility. So you have to appeal. The best way to do it, if you're not one of these people, and neither am I, Christine, mm-hmm. is to bring in the right person.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
maybe dispatch them to a separate conference room and let the two of them go talk it out.
Hash it out.
Yeah, right. Yeah, as a salesperson, I mean,
bar the doors.
Yeah, unfortunately, what happens is when they start going into too much detail, all I hear is wah, 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 wah,
the
wah.
Charlie Brown thing, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got that. Yeah, but again, I think to...
And I glaze over, and then I lose the sale.
Well...
You know, so that's well, when I have bring to bring...
You're the quarterback. You're the quarterback.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
And you just have to trust that your position players are going to execute their, you know, the game plan effectively.
Right.
As
right.
a salesperson, you are the quarterback of the team.
All right, so I want to change gears a little bit around a conversation. Question. So we think about sales and how it's changed over the last 5 to 10 years. Let's call it just last 10 years. And you think about how long Frontline's been around. You think about how our sales careers and our careers, period, have been around. The invent and the introduction of this thing called social media, how do you see that changing sales and impacting sales?
It gets to the point Mike's talking about. It gets the message out there, whether the message is... You know, a lot of your peers are experiencing this pain. You know, do you run into this problem? Have you got this problem? Do you see this sort of shortage or your numbers not growing the way you want them to grow? Because in reality, you know, if you have a good sales team, your numbers should be growing about 20% a year. If you have an average sales team, it's growing about 7%. And if you've got a below average, a bottom quartile sales team, your numbers are actually dropping year by year. So where are you in there? And then the other issue about talking about the positives, but it's kind of like people aren't going to go to a doctor unless they feel pain, and they've got to understand they've got pain, and then they got to have some idea that, you know, somebody can solve this pain. I saw this commercial for Restasis yesterday about tears, and I'm thinking, I wonder how many people have this problem where they don't manufacture enough tears, and I'm thinking, I wonder how much this stuff must cost. You know, I've never known anybody had this problem, and yet they're on national TV advertising this stuff. But, you know, over and over again, if I've got that problem, I'm going to go to my doctor and say, hey, what's this Restasis stuff? Can this solve my problem?
Hmm.
Okay, a little off the topic here, or kind of. It's pulling it in. United States and I think Australia are the only countries that allow, pardon me, B2C marketing with pharmaceuticals. And so, therefore, we spend a tremendous amount of money on those. Because if I thought, I didn't even know that there was such a thing as like loss of tears, then now I need to call my doctor and go do it. So that really ties into what you were saying, Mike. It's that creating the need. Because I didn't even know that there was a solution for this little dry eye thing that I kind of thought I might have. And so, anyway, they're doing it well. I think that we should probably just follow what the pharmaceutical companies
they are
doing.
Good. They are very good at
it. Yeah.
But to your point about social media, you can use Twitter, you can blog, and you can then, you know, point people to a white paper you wrote or a short little clip, and I noticed that the people that I happen to follow in the industry, that's how I got to them originally. I saw something somewhere, and then I get either something on a LinkedIn group that I'm part of, or a social media feed or something like that, and I'll go after them. I don't really give rats about my cousin's infatuation with coffee, and I don't look at her coffee blog, but I know she's got a couple hundred people that follow her. So you can create a following on virtually any topic that's got some level of interest out there. You just got to be somewhat consistent and get it out there. But things have changed. 20 years ago, people were saying, well, the internet will never replace salespeople. Mm-hmm. Well, it has replaced some low-level salespeople already, number one. Number two, it's also taken away a lot of the early stages of the pipeline. The prospecting is very important. But once people are looking, something I read said that by the time a sales rep gets in front of a customer, he's looked in the B2B environment, that customer is about 60% of the way through the buying process because they understand they got a problem. They've looked and researched, and they know four or five companies that are available to solve that problem. So they're down the path. So if you do a typical show up and throw up, here's the first slide. This is our logo and your logo. Here's the second slide. We've been around for, it's just kind of like, don't do that. The internet already did that for you.
Well,
social media already
informed
did that for
at this
you.
Point.
Yeah.
So,
they're much
more
informed.
Of the selling processes that we know. I mean, the Miller Hyman's, the Huthwaite, the spin selling, complex sale, whatever that might be, these were all designed prior to Google.
Sure.
And so I think the selling process has morphed, and I think it's continuing to morph. So I'm just always curious as to see, your view of how social media is changing and impacting business metrics, business world, and selling as a result of that. So any experience with some of your clients?
I think that LinkedIn has been a godsend. And I just find that a lot of people that I work with use it, and that it's very helpful. Now, I'm not a Twitter user, but I think that it's a great way that in this huge world that we have, that you have some little connection with people. And even if you have 2,000 people that you're friends with on LinkedIn, I don't know that, but if you have a contact that I want to see or likewise, it's so nice to be able to help somebody out, because I think in this digital age that there's like no touch going on, that to be able to have some kind of direct connection really has, it makes you feel like you're a human being again. And I think that we're kind of striving to do that more and more now, because it's just been kind of barren in a sense.
Yeah, if you get to the right ones, and you can look around for things, but one of my clients is in the legal space, and as a result of a LinkedIn search, I'm now part of the Association of Litigation Professionals, and I can see what's on their mind, and then I can customize messaging to get at them without doing these blatant commercials. I mean, nothing turns me off worse than, hey, buy this on a social media thing.
Mm-hmm.
I hate that. But the people who say, here's a paper about, or here's how you solve this particular problem and a discussion about that, I'll go look at those things. A lot of people, particularly younger ones, are doing more and more of that. And that's I got a couple of kids that they don't call you, they text you.
Sure. Absolutely.
Well, and I just think that the whole idea of social media, and as Joe mentioned before, is that the buyers are, it's a resource for them. It's fundamentally changed the way we go out and sell and communicate, and even a whole generation, as my kids don't even text as much as they just Facebook one another, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
So the whole idea is that we have these social media tools are out there. I think we're just barely scratching the surface on that, because very few people actually participate are the leaders, the thought leaders, the folks that post stuff. And there's lots of people who do following, and they get impacted on a very casual basis. But the whole idea of social media, and as Joe mentioned, is that these buyers, they have a place to do research. All you need to do is just say, hey, has anybody ever, you go into one of your groups, has anybody ever tried this company or this product or whatever, and you'll get 10 or 12 opinions, and it just streamlines a whole bunch of time. So mm-hmm. not only are they giving you information, mm-hmm. they are also promoting. So customer relationships, customer experiences are ultra that much more important today. But the thing I think you're going to see in social media, because it is so it's becoming so pervasive, is that even though we might have 200 or 500 or 1,000 LinkedIn connections, every day we're finding people, oh, I remember that guy from, 10 years ago, or I mm-hmm. know that person. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's still way more people we're not connected to than we are. So, and so it's not the only, that's only a one, network group, if you will. What we're seeing is, how do we use social media? And there's this whole burgeoning industry around sales intelligence, because when people mm-hmm. start moving from one company to another, or somebody posts something, or just you start seeing activity, and we're starting to see a lot of companies out there, and I could give a shout out to a company here in Atlanta called SalesLoft, who's built some technology that scrapes social media sites where you can put in some criteria. It's really neat stuff. So rather than me, stalking Steve's Facebook page every day, I can just get an alert and say, hey, if something happens on these topics or something like that, I really want to know about it. And so sales intelligence is really, I think, the next wave of taking social media to the next level.
Right, and that really helps in the prospecting stages, and then it helps in the early diagnosis stage.
Yeah, especially identifying who are the most likely candidates for me to sell to today.
Right.
Good. And I think that because you just gave a whole new context to the word, there's something I was reading in the Harvard Business Review around the new marketing is the customer service.
Right.
Because if someone had a bad experience with you, they're going to go and post it up on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, whatever it might be.
There's a great HBR article from years ago that says you only need to survey one thing in marketing, is that is, would they recommend you to another buyer?
Yep.
So that'll tell you everything right then and there.
Mm-hmm. Good. All right. We're going to wrap things up, but I have one last question as we move into something, and that is, so we have a new person coming into sales. What kind of counsel, guidance would you give that individual coming into the world of business development and this thing called sales profession that we all live and breathe every day? What's your few bit of advice that you might share?
Oh, gosh. I would just say find the most successful salesperson, and mimic that golf swing.
Good. Mm-hmm. I like that. All right, Mike.
I would say, I guess probably two things. One was, this old adage about you got two ears and one mouth, so use them in that ratio. And number two, there was something I learned at an AT&T sales management training years ago, and it was boldness, boldness, always boldness.
I like that.
Separates you. It's Frederick the Great. It's in French typically, but I don't attempt to pronounce French.
Joe, I thought you were going to tell them hunt now or starve.
Oh, well, that's the other one.
that's one of my favorites.
Definitely true.
I would recommend that they find something that they absolutely love and go and sell it, and make sure that they're going to be able to sell it to people that they can connect with.
Good. I like that. Good. All right. So I think that was we'll have a wrap up on that. So if we could, Mike, tell us, Comedy Frontline, how's best to reach you?
Is either on the web, frontlineselling.com, or call me directly, 770-777-9336.
Good. Joe?
770-279-7373 or fixmysalesteams.com.
I like that. Fix My Sales Teams. Good. Thanks, Joe.
And the business revision, actually, it's business without the D. Businessrevisionist.com or direct is 404-713-2135.
All right, Christine. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
All right. Thank you. As a wrap, we are bringing it to a close. I appreciate your time, and I think we had a pretty good show. Andy, what do you think?
I think we did, too. I think we're going to have these guys back again because I feel like we've only scratched the surface of their expertise.
Absolutely.
And, I'd like to carve a little more of that knowledge up before we quit.
And I think I found myself actually becoming a listener at some points during the show, so I know that was a good show. I forgot that I was the host.
Well, also, Christine put you on the spot. She talked about being a runner. I understand you're engaging the running a little here lately.
Yeah, but I have an injury right now, so that's a whole. It's an old injury from football days. So.
Joe, he's got the treadmill in the basement.
I got clothes on it though. It's drying right now.
Right. It does serve a purpose.
That's right. All right. Well, this is Steve Cadley from Atlanta Sales Talk Radio and Andy Lowe. We are signing off. And just to remind you that everybody is always in sales. So happy selling. Until next time we meet.
Thanks a lot.